Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Tonight we have a Sword and Sandal Cinema special and crossover with Mythic Physique. It's a tribute to the legendary Reg Park, his legacy in cinema and bodybuilding. And as well as myself, we have Brian Walker of Brian Straubin Theater and Bill Hinburn of Super Strength Training. Before we begin the show, let me just start with a few words about Reg Park. To me, Reg Park's physique has always represented the pinnacle of what was achievable during the peplum era. Aside from being an iconic actor and bodybuilder, Reg was also a very successful businessman. Anecdotal accounts portray him as a warm and friendly individual dedicated to his family and friends. He was also devoted to his sport and mentored many young hopefuls, including Arnold Schwarzenegger. Reg Park, 1928 to 2007, portrayed Hercules and Machiste in 5 sword and sandal epics. He won 14 titles as a professional bodybuilder. Reg the Ledge, short for the legend, left behind a rich legacy of instruction that includes his famous 5x5 bodybuilding routine and a cable workout. His dietary practices, health habits, and philosophies have been preserved for posterity as well. These treasures are a roadmap to success that have benefited many. Thank you, Reg Park, for all your contributions, your uniquely carefree yet loving and devout portrayal of my operant archetype has inspired me for over half a century. It will no doubt continue to inspire me for the rest of my earthly sojourn. For that, I now express my sincere gratitude. And I will begin with a very brief impression of one of Reg's movies. Recently, I rewatched Hercules, Prisoner of Evil, starring Reg Park. I recall watching this adventure under various other titles over the years, and I seem to recall seeing another Hercules tale called Prisoner of Evil at some point in the past. Faulty memory, the fluidity of peplum titles, who can say? But it matters not, for I love watching these movies again and again. In this atypical mythological epic, Hercules is a barbarian chieftain vying with fierce Mongol tribes. The prize they all seek, who among them will be the great Khan? There's a mysterious monster, lots of intrigue, a secret love affair with the Khan's daughter, and the return of Hercules' younger brother, a man with his own agenda. After watching this film, I unburdened myself of whatever mythic stereotype still held sway in my psyche and opened myself up to new creative possibilities in archetypal expression. And with that, we move onward. Greetings and welcome, Brian, and greetings and welcome, Bill.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello, Hercules. How are you doing tonight?
Awesome. I'm really looking forward to the show. I guess we'll start with Brian from Brian's Drive-In Theater, who will cover Reg Park's films.
Okay. As you know, today's movie of the day is Hercules and the Haunted World.
Awesome.
Which was, I believe, his first film. I believe it was produced first, and then Hercules Conquers Atlantis was second. It's, as you know, Hercules in the Haunted World was directed by one of my favorite Italian horror directors, Mario Bava, who had a really nice eye for creating atmospheric sets, you know, just with lighting. Which is sort of his hallmark. You know, it's something that Mario Bava was very good at. Was using lighting and shadows, you know, in order to set the mood for a particular film. And Hercules in the Haunted World has another one of my favorite actors in it, Christopher Lee. So
yeah.
You know, between the two of them, you really can't go wrong. And you know, it's a shame that Reg Park only made four films. The last film that he's credited for is Hercules the Avenger. At least that's the as translated English title. But it's really kind of a compendium of a couple of his other movies, you know, mostly edited together. So I only look at it as that in that he really made only four films. But just out of those four films, he really kind of cemented sort of the look of what you know, we expect Hercules to be at least in the early 60s peplums. You know, Steve Reeves started that, but I think Reg Park actually, you know, added something to it.
I do too. He represented to me and still represents the pinnacle of what was attainable in that era.
And just, you know, the physicality of his performance, it's really riveting, you know, to watch, you know, any of his movies. And, you know, I know that he didn't really have any acting training, but he seems to be pretty natural with it. He's not stiff, as you would expect a novice to be. Actually, he seems very relaxed and very poised in all of his films. And, you know, even the first one, Hercules in the Haunted World, he does a great job in it.
That he does. They're very memorable. And like you said, he became iconic through these films. And to very many people, he represents Hercules.
Well, and if you look at, you know, the direction, the set, the backgrounds in all of Reg Park's films, they're, you know, a cut above a lot of the other peplums. You can tell that, you know, there was a little more money spent on them, maybe a little more time taken with the production, and certainly more seasoned people behind the camera. You know, directors, camera people and such, because, you know, all of his films are beautifully shot. They're not all directed by the same person. Unfortunately, Mario Bava only directed one of Reg Park's films. But just to watch, you know, all of his films, you can tell that there was some money behind. I tried to find out, you know, what his salary would have been for each of his four films, and I was unable to do so. You know, Steve Reeves was the highest paid, you know, of the bunch, and he made about $250,000 per film. He could command, you know, that kind of money. I don't think anybody else could really do that so much. But like I said, the production values in Park's films really seem to be, you know, almost a cut above most of the others.
That they did. Why was the Ursus movie not turned into a Hercules movie? Because back then it was common practice to, again, title everything in different ways, and the hero would change to reflect the interest of wherever it was showing.
Well, you know, in the United States, we weren't really all that familiar with the legend of Ursus or Machiste. You know, the names that came up were usually, you know, Hercules and Samson. So when anything was, you know, dubbed for the American market, you know, they, you know, often switched over, not always, but often switched over to one of those two names. I can't really explain that in Hercules, Prisoner of Evil. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense that, you know, it's titled as one thing, but he has the name Ursus. Not really sure about that. I wish there was more information out there. I would love to know, for example, who dubbed all of these films. And I've run into people here and there, you know, throughout the course of the last 23 years of my website, who say that they dubbed a lot of, you know, Italian films for the U.S. market in the early 1960s. But there doesn't really seem to be any good record of it, unfortunately. It's a shame. It would be nice to know, you know, who dubbed whom. If you watch as many of these movies as you and I clearly have, you hear the same voices. You hear the same two or three voices as the hero. You hear a lot of the same female voices as well. So it's clear that, you know, a lot of these were done probably, you know, within a year or so of each other with kind of a stock, you know, group doing them.
The stories seem to be – and, Bill, if you have any questions, feel free to just pop in anytime too.
Sure.
The films the ones with Reg Park – seem to have like a consistent story behind Hercules, at least in the two best ones, in The Underworld and then Against Atlantis, Conquers Atlantis. It seems to be the same Hercules worse than the other ones. It could be anybody, really.
Well, I'm not sure about the release of the other two films that he did, Yamachiste and King Solomon's Mines, and then Hercules, Prisoner of Evil. Oftentimes when they were being redubbed and perhaps edited for a particular market, if it was going to go into theaters, that the dubbing production values might have been a little higher. But if it was going straight to television, and some of these did, I'm not sure about, like I said, his second two films. But some of them were sold into a television syndication package that I believe American International Pictures put together in the early to mid '60s. Just as the the genre would, just as they were able to, let's say, ride the wave of the genre. And then they needed, films in bulk. So, they would pull about 20 titles out and then, market them really quickly to get them into that syndication package.
Now, Bill has shared, because he knows Reg Parks' family and you, Reg Parks. So he shared a lot of interesting information about how Reg got involved with the movies and why he stopped. Bill, would you care to share that?
Sure. I really don't know where you would like me to begin. You don't want me to go back to how we got started in weightlifting and bodybuilding. You probably want to stay around the movies, right?
Right, and then in the second half of the show, we're going to focus on his bodybuilding and things like that.
Well, he won Mr. Universe a second time. In 1958. Now, when I talked to him back in the 70s, he told me that he was approached by movie producers. I don't know who. I don't recall the name. But somewhere between 1958 and 1961, when he made the first one, Hercules and the Captive Women, he was approached, and they said, we would like you to star in our Hercules movies, because, of course, Steve Reeves was the first Hercules, and, later on they wanted Reg Park. And Reg Park at the time lived in South Africa, and they said they're going to be made in Italy, okay, for proximity, where he had to go. And he says, but I don't speak Italian. And they replied, it didn't matter. And he agreed on the condition that he be given first-class round-trip ticket and a first-class accommodations for the screen test. And they agreed to it. And he went there, and they were very happy with his performance. Now, here's one key point that a lot of people don't know. Steve Reeves was required to lose body weight for his role, because as you know, when you go to the cinema and you're on film, you automatically gain 10 pounds or whatever they say.
10 pounds. Yeah.
And for whatever reason, they wanted Steve Reeves to lose weight, and Steve Reeves was never really big, certainly nowhere near as big as Reg Park at that time. They were about the same, I'd say, in 1950 when they competed. But the thing was, he didn't have to cut weight, so he looked far more massive and bigger than Steve Reeves. And he told me he really enjoyed making movies. He would have continued doing it, but of course, the sword and sandal fad passed, and it opened the door for Westerns to be made in Italy. And he said the money was terrific. And again, like you, Brian, I don't know how much he got paid. I certainly didn't ask him. But he said he got paid very, very well. He thought the money was terrific. He emphasized that. And at that time, he was operating gyms. And he also had a mail-order business that was being operated out of Leeds, England, which he had for several years. So he was very busy. all of his gyms were in South Africa. But as far as the movies, you know, like you say, there's he made five with his name attached, and that fifth one, like you say, that was like they say, probably the cuts that fell on the floor, you know, that were compiled together, and that was the final one was released in August of 1965. The first one was released in August of 61. So he had a 4-year run there. But whether he would have continued making those kind of movies, I confess I really don't know. Right around the time the last movie was made, Hercules the Avenger, or released, I should say, he won Mr. Universe for the third and final time. So he was a busy guy. He was traveling quite a bit.
Thank you. That was awesome. That filled in a lot of the blank areas.
Well, he was a big. By the way, speaking of movies, he was a big influence on Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
As he of course was European also, and from Austria specifically, he mentored Arnold. There was also one other fella in a gym owner in England. But Arnold looked up to him and always gives him credit. Anytime he ever sees people who helped him, he's always mentioning his name and gave him direction. And because Arnold was influenced by Rich Burke, he was one of the first ones that he saw in the cinema, and he was just overwhelmed. He says, that's what I want to do right there. And I talked to Arnold about this early 1970s when his accent was far, far thicker than it is now. He was very hard to understand back then.
Uh-huh.
And he told me that it was Rich Pock. And he would influence the he would explain what the influence was, you know, what he had to do and everything, and he gave him direction in that area. And, of course, Arnold, being the type of person that he is, he also was very industrious and ambitious, and anything that he set out to do, he was successful. You know, he even went into politics. But Arnold made several movies. You know, the ones that come to mind for me, of course, is Conan the Barbarian, and of course, his trademark, The Terminator, I'll Be Back, you know. So Reg Park did have a tremendous influence, as well as Steve Reeves. And their fame, here's the thing, the fame for all three of them, Steve Reeves, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Reg Park, is that, yes, they were famous in bodybuilding, but it was a stepping stone to the cinema. The cinema is what gave them worldwide recognition.
Mm-hmm.
If it was not for the cinema, the average person on the street wouldn't know who they were.
That's very, very true. And people like Brian have kept the flame of those films alive for decades.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He does a remarkable – Brian, you do a remarkable job, I have to say.
Well, thank you, Bill. I appreciate that.
Yes, you do. I've been on your website. I've seen a lot of the stuff that you've done, and you know it's important to perpetuate that sort of thing. One other thing I'd like to bring up while I have you on the phone, Brian, and Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something that I find really interesting. Steve Reeves, I had spoke to him several times, he was offered the starring role that Clint Eastwood took, The Man with No Name. And I think it's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Isn't that the one?
Actually, I think it's A Fistful of Dollars.
A Fistful of Dollars. Okay, I get the two confused. But I always like those movies. Steve
mm-hmm.
Reeves
very much.
Turned that role down. He was offered it first. He turned it down. Now, the reason he gave, you're going to love this. The reason he gave, he says, I don't think Italians can make Westerns. Now, what's ironic is Steve Reeves was very much a Western type person. He was born in Colorado and went around horses. He raised Morgan horses for years on its ranch in Escondido. He produced the movie, A Long Ride from Hell. That was one of the names of it. It was not a big hit, but nevertheless, A Long Ride from Hell, a Western. You know where it was made? Italy. I find that very ironic, you know, because if he would have listened to his later self, so to speak, and said, maybe I'll look into this Fistful of Dollars. Can you just imagine how history would change? You know, it's just like he was offered, off the top of my head, I can't think of what they are, but he was offered other roles, you know, and he simply turned them down, you know, for whatever reason. I don't know. Sometimes, of course, that's very common in the industry, as you well know, Brian. A lot of these actors, they have contract conflicts, or they're working on another film, so there's a conflict there, and they can't, you know, get away to do a particular film. Or, in many cases, they look at the script, I don't like it. You know, some of them can be, you know, picky. Other ones are other ones are hungry. They'll take anything, so you have to catch them at the right time. But I just when I read that, I thought that was remarkable. You know.
Yeah, imagine a world without.
Well, and there were some peplum actors, you know, who did go on, and you know, some of those were the hungry ones, like Gordon Mitchell, who you know, racked up a gigantic filmography, and he was everything from the hero to the villain to you know, somebody. You know, just a supporting player.
Yeah.
He would do pretty much anything. Now, for somebody like Steve Reeves, I mean, he's the you know the progenitor. He's the original Hercules, and he was making such good money. I mean, he really made a bigger handful of films than Reg Park, but not
oh yeah, yeah.
Not a lot of movies. But you know, if you were a pretty savvy business person, if you did invest it. I'm sure you. It was a pretty handsome sum back then.
Oh my gosh, yeah. You mean you're speaking of Reg Park? Oh yeah, yeah. He made very good money, and of course he had other things going. He had a string of gems at the time. Keep in mind, this wasn't his only. And he also had the mail order business that his father started, and of course he carried on. It's interesting you say that Christopher Lee. Did you like him? I like him too. I thought he was, he's a very good no good Nick.
Well, and with Christopher Lee, he made great movies and he made terrible movies.
Yes.
But I have a lot of respect for the man, however. And even when he's in a terrible movie, he's still good in it. So
yes.
He can turn a movie around.
Yeah.
And he can make something that is terrible watchable.
Yeah, yeah. And he's an interesting background, if you've ever read any of his background. He's an interesting person. But
very.
Yeah. But it's interesting, all of these movies, these ones that Reg Park made, you know, the only name that I see that's recognizable is Christopher Lee. Of course, even though they were made in Europe, and specifically Italy, I don't recognize any of those other names, okay? Faye Spain, I beg your pardon. Faye Spain is the
yes.
first one, yeah. Faye Spain, of course. I didn't recognize the other ones. But, you know, the other thing about these is that, like I said, it took a turn after the Hercules was pretty much beat to death. You know, there's just so many that were coughed out in a short period of time, not only with Reeves and Park, but several other actors that you're far more familiar with as far as stars and the names of the movies, you know, he just switched over to Westerns. you know. And then the Westerns took off. And then after the Westerns, it was the of course, James Bond, you know.
You're a spy, yes.
Yeah, you know, the secret agent type stuff. But whatever would sell at the time, you know, I mean, it's a market. But these movies are so low budget, you know. But by the same token, if you want to talk low budget, and I don't want to get off on a tangent too far off, but take, for example, Star Wars. You know, the first one that was produced, of course, it was the third in the series, but the first one that was produced, that was very low budget. And they got a bunch of actors that either were nobodies or up and coming or were burned out, ready for retirement, like Peter Cushing, who was also a good friend of Lee, of Christopher Lee, and starred in a lot of the horror movies, you know. But, you know, and all of those actors in the first one, you know, like Harrison Ford and David Prowse, who played Darth Vader, and a few of the other ones, they all looked at each other when they were making the movie thinking, well, it's just another movie. You know, we're going to be waiting tables when this is done, so we might as well make the best of it, you know. They never, ever, ever had any idea that it would take off like it did. None of them. They thought this is, you know, here it is.
And
you know,
Christopher Lee, too, he redefined himself for a new generation. I grew up knowing him primarily as Dracula. He was an iconic Dracula with Bela Lugosi. Now, for people, he's either Count Dooku or Saruman, the wizard.
So
he's redefined himself and he's reached all new people.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, the quality of a lot of the Italian films you know, that were made in the 60s, I mean, they were churning them out, you know, for a worldwide audience, and they didn't have, you know, the biggest budgets or the longest production schedules. But I think that, you know, on the whole, a lot of these Peplum movies look great, especially when you look at the cost of production. Now, a lot of it's sort of the natural settings, you know, available to, you know, film crews in Italy. So you don't have to construct a set. You can go to the ruins themselves, which has got to save
some
money.
And back, yeah.
And even, you know, especially when they're doing location shots, you know, the exteriors are beautiful. And they're, again, you know, very low cost because, you know, most of it's already there. And, you know, there's something very cinematic about, you know, all of these peplums. They are done on a grand scale. You know, some of them, and I'm watching Hercules and the Captive Women, otherwise known as Hercules Conquers Atlantis right now. There must be like 200 extras on the set right now in the scene that I'm looking at. I mean, that you could not make a low-budget movie, even back in the early 60s in the U.S., with that many people on the set. I mean, it would have just been prohibitively expensive.
Now, the old cast of thousands, you know, like with the Ben-Hur, you know, the you know, movies like that, or the Ten Commandments, you know, the same color type arrangement. The cost would be enormous. But like I say, just like with like I mentioned earlier, to keep the cost down with Star Wars, they got all these people that were hungry, you know. They were either washed up or just starting out. You know, it made Harrison Ford, you know.
He was about ready to give up.
Yeah, he was a carpenter.
He'd been working off and on for years.
Right.
You know, he'd started
in
the early 60s.
Yeah. And he, you know, he was ready to throw in the tub. There's a lot of actors like that. You know, my son used to work out in Hollywood, you know. And he said, Dad, you know, we went out there to visit one time. He says, we're going to go to dinner on occasion, and don't be surprised if you see somebody that you recognize. They're between jobs. And sure enough, there was a couple of them I did see from a distance. Oh, yeah, they weren't super big names, you know. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they draw unemployment just like everybody else if they're between, you know, pictures. So, you know, that's just the type of work that they're in, you know. And the whole thing is, a lot of it is luck. You know, you hit it big. You happen to be a stand-in. You have no billing, okay? But the picture takes off, and, you know, everybody sees you constantly. And it isn't just the moviegoers. It's the people that are in the business, and they happen to see you and see your acting or whatever, and, you know, offer you
and
work.
And if you look at, you know, some of the backgrounds of people who are, you know, famous today, a lot of it's nepotism too.
and who they're related to.
You can exactly, you know, if you know, grandpa was a famous director, or, you know, maybe mom was an agent, you know, something like that. If you trace the origin of a lot of contemporary actors, you'll find that, you know, they are like third generation in their family, you know, working actors. Maybe the names are a little different, but, you know, you can usually trace people back. Not for everybody. I mean, occasionally there is that, you know, kid from the Midwest who makes it big.
Yeah.
But more often you're dealing with somebody like Gwyneth Paltrow, who was born, you know, into sort of Hollywood royalty.
Oh, a lot of them have been. My gosh, I can go down the list. It's you know, the sad thing about it is they stink as actors. I mean, anybody could fill that role. It just so happens they're the baby that was brought home from the hospital, like my father used to say. It was just the luck of the draw that they're related. And they're handed down generation after generation, you know. But there they are, you know. And a lot of them struggle for many years, like George Clooney. You know, you talk about Harrison Ford from the 60s, but George Clooney was on daytime soap operas for years and years, and then finally he made it big, you know. Steve Martin was another one, with Saturday Night Live. He, you're doing stand-up and stuff like that, but he said, I was down to the point where I was going to give it one more chance, and then I was going to go in a completely different line of work. Well, that one more chance did it. And then he went into the movies and, you know, again, he became a star. But, yeah, a lot of it is nepotism, who you're related to, you know, and it just carries on from there.
It does, but there also has to be a little bit of spark there as well. No matter how you got there, you have to try to stay there. And that seems to be the more difficult of the two tasks.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the actor, and I can't remember. I think it was a Hercules. The way I think it was Steve Reeves that got discovered for Hercules. They happened to see him. He was out in Hollywood. I think it was him. This may be the wrong story, but he was out in Hollywood, and a film director's daughter. Just a young kid.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one?
That's Steve Reeves.
She said, "Daddy, that's the Hercules. That's our Hercules right there." And that's how he was discovered, you know, I mean, for the part. You know, so, you know, it's, what is it, the right place at the right time, I guess? And somebody happens to see you, or... Like I said earlier, somebody's waiting tables, and they happen to walk up and wait on the table that has a director, and the director is looking for somebody desperately, and he's got a deadline. And the young lady or the gentleman that walks up and waits on him looks just like the part or whatever, you know. Who's to say, you know, how often that happens? I don't know.
Now, Wiggle, so Wrench Park, too, he was discovered for, he was already famous in some field of endeavor in bodybuilding and gym owning and exercise equipment and courses. And because at the time bodybuilding was the fad, and these Hercules movies or the sword and sandals genre was very popular, he too was he went past his destiny and embraced the new destiny, which again we're still talking about him now. Brian is has his website, Darwin Theater, and you have his courses. You know, so you're keeping him immortal through your work. And you have a very extensive amount of his courses available.
Yeah, he wrote and published over eight. I carry eight of the most prevalent and most important. And they're every bit as popular today as they were back then. So you got to figure that's around, 60 years ago that they were, in fact, in some cases, closer to 70 years ago that they were written. And they're still relevant today. And his popularity is still there. If you go on the Internet, you type in Reg Park, you get a jillion hits, not only my website, but several other ones. And the same way with Steve Reeves and certainly Arnold Schwarzenegger. People can identify with Schwarzenegger because, you know, he's not only still alive, you know, but his movies are of recent vintage, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas you go to Reg Park and Steve Reeves, you know, they're more or less, you know, back in the day. But people still look them up, you know. I would have to say that Steve Reeves, more than anybody else during the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, caused more young men to pick up barbells than anyone else. They went to see his – I know I did. I went to see his movie. I nearly died. You know, I saw it I saw it when it came out, you know,
wow.
1957. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Paid a whopping 50 cents and got a Hershey bar and a box of popcorn, and I was ready to go, you know.
I was born when it came to this country and made its debut, you know, so I'm a sword and sandal baby. I was born in that cave when it came to America.
Yeah, and then I saw the later, and this was, of course, in the 60s, and I didn't see it when they first came out, but I saw the Reg Park movies a few years after they were out, okay? And I was just absolutely awestruck. I thought, you know, Steve Reeves is built, but this guy is huge, you know.
Yes.
It's tremendous, you know. And there's been several guys that play Hercules, you know. You have Ferrigno and people. And, of course, Arnold did a Hercules in New Yorker. I think it's also called Hercules Goes Bananas in 1970, and that was dubbed in. It had to be dubbed in because you wouldn't be able to understand a word he said. I mean, his accent was thick, man.
They have now dubbed and undubbed. One of the DVDs that I have has both versions, where he's dubbed, and the other one is the original one. It's quite a quite a difference, as you say. In understanding. Joe Weider told the producers of this movie that he had Shakespearean experience in Austria, which wasn't true.
Yeah, he took an English class. That's probably as close to Shakespearean as he ever got. Yeah, that's interesting.
And there was a film about Schwarzenegger. I forget which film it was, where they had him as bodybuilder and as politician later on in life, and kept going back and forth. And do you know that movie, Brian?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay, yeah, I don't remember the title. But there they had him. Initially, he wanted to be an actor. But the person that he was working with on his acting told him, no, you want to be a superstar from everything you're saying. Don't bother with acting. Give him that, that raw muscularity, give him that attitude, and they'll eat it up. And that's what he eventually did. And that's when his superstardom began, because before that he was in several roles and he played several parts, but then he became an iconic phenomenon in and of himself.
That's interesting.
Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, the other thing about Arnold, when he first started out, in the movies and stuff like that. There was a point prior to, well, right around the time he started the movies, that he changed his name from Schwarzenegger to Strong.
Yes.
And someone told him that's not a good idea. You keep that name Schwarzenegger. You're never going to have anybody ever get confused with a name like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he said, by the way, you want top billing. Well, Arnold Arnold took it to a length.
Yes.
That's the first thing you see is his name in many movies before you see anything else, before you see the title. It comes on Arnold Schwarzenegger or just Schwarzenegger in big block letters. And then it'll go on and, you know, talk about the movie or the prelude to it or whatever. I found that interesting. You'll see that in a lot of his early movies. And you get these big, bold letters out there, you know.
Yeah, Arnold was not, like, in some areas of his life, he's not a good example to follow. But in many areas of his life, he is. And you could learn a lot about marketing, about self-promotion, about visualization, about not giving up. And lately he's been making these remarkable motivational videos that they put on YouTube and other places that are remarkable, just very powerful and inspiring.
Well, he learned a lot about marketing when he came over here because, you know, he's a bodybuilder and all that, and it didn't pay worth – it didn't pay anything back then in the late 60s. Okay, so he came over here, and he had a little friend, Franco Colombo. He was from Sardinia, which is an island off Italy, and he couldn't speak a lick of English either. So here they are over here, and what do? To, you know, support themselves, they start a bricklaying business. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so the two of them, you know, are from another country, and that impresses some people because they figure automatically that if you speak with an accent, you must be a real craftsman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say they were good bricklayers. I have no reason to believe they weren't, okay? But business was slow. And so they're having lunch with a guy, and I can't remember the guy's name. But anyway, they're talking to him, and he says, how's business? And they say, well, it's really not so good. It's a little slow right now. He says, why? You guys do good work. Well, we don't know, you know, and stuff like that. He says, I'll tell you what you ought to do. What's the name of your business? And it was something like, you know, Arnold and Franco's bricklaying business or whatever, something without any real pizzazz to it. He says, this is what you should do. He says, old world bricklaying. Okay? Old world, use old world or custom or something like that. Put that in there. Okay? Well, they did. And their business took off like crazy. They couldn't keep up with it. They didn't change a thing other than
the
what
name.
They described them. Yeah, the name. How they described themselves. I can't remember what it was, what the name was. It's either Old World or European Craftsmanship or something like that. They built it up, okay, and they gave it some pizzazz, you know, and that's all it took.
I heard that they even went around buying, like, old chimneys and things like that and recycling the bricks because they looked antique.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, there's a big market.
Overboard with it.
There's a big market for that. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, Brian, did he bring Frank Colombo with him into any other movies than Conan? Because I know, in Conan.
I am not really sure. That's a good question. I know that they were really thick, for a long time. But I'm not really sure about that.
Yeah, because I know they were looking out for each other in various ways. But, yeah, according to the bodybuilding magazines I grew up with, you knew that they were not only friends, but like best friends, and they had a long history, and, you know, the tales of their adventures, including a part of the story that you shared, Bill, those were being written. And when I saw Conan, I recognized Franco underneath his wig and all the body.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen all of Arnold's movies, so I was just wondering if anybody knew. If,
well, you know, it's
well,
a funny
actually,
thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
actually,
go right ahead,
Brian. Hercules. I got into IMDb, and Franco Colombo was in not only Conan, but he's in Terminator and Predator.
Okay.
Now he's got small. He has small roles, but he is in them.
That is awesome. And
yeah, Arnold has a reputation for loyalty. If
yeah.
you ever did him any good in the beginning when he was, you know, starting out, he never forgets that. Never. He's got a number of people that he has a ferocious loyalty to them. Of course, Reg Park's one of them. Franco's another one.
Yeah.
And there's a few other people. Joe Gold, Gold's Jim. That was another one. But anybody who ever did him a good turn, he doesn't forget.
Which is an admirable thing.
Yeah.
It's always nice to hear that there's, you know, an actor has gratitude.
it is.
You don't often hear that about people, especially people who, you know, achieved what he has.
That's very, very true. No, that's... That's very true. There are some that are very humble, you know, and there are other ones that that's just a whole other story. But it's like any other people. I mean, it's you know, some people are very. Oh, for example, Jack Nicholson is very appreciative of where he's at. And a friend of mine that was in a the movie that they did here, some of it was filmed in Detroit, nearby Detroit. He was in a movie called Hoffa, and he played the starring role. And a friend of mine was a stand-in. He was what they call a regular person. I think they call them regular people. But anyway, it was, you know, just local people, a handful of local people, and they were in a union crowd, you know, waving their banners and all that stuff. And he walked up to him during a break or whatever and asked for his autograph. And Nicholson was, of course, all made up, and his face was like, puttied and everything, and it was like he was very stiff. He could hardly talk, but my friend said he was very appreciative, and he says, "What is your name?" And he told him, he says, "I'm very, very glad to meet you," and he signed the autograph like that. You could tell he wasn't, you know, he didn't blow him off or anything. So, you know, you got to remember, it's the people that stand out in the rain that are paying your wages.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But there are a number of actors these days who will not sign autographs anymore.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them will blame it on, you know, the market, like eBay. I'm sure there are some opportunists around who, you know, have gotten people to sign some glossies or something like that and then immediately, you know, try to turn them around on eBay for more money. I'm sure that happens. In fact,
I've got valuable autographs I've had for years. I mean, very valuable. I had a Bruce Lee autograph around here somewhere, the martial artist. But here, I'll tell you a story, a real quick story about the autograph bit. Paul Newman, he was interviewed one time, and they asked him, you have a reputation for not giving out autographs. He said, well, I used to give out autographs anytime. I didn't have any problem. And, you know, you have people that, you know, if you're out to dinner or something with your wife, and they'll come up to the table and stuff like that. He says, that's one thing. He says, yeah, it's a little irritating, but I think it goes with the territory. But the thing that did it for me is when I was in a restroom standing at a urinal and somebody walked up and wanted an autograph, he said, that did it for me. So I said to myself, well, I don't think I can disagree with that.
You know, I don't know what the market is like anymore. Well, the pandemic has sort of killed any of the autograph conventions, you know, that used to pop up across the country, any of the horror cons or the Western actors will oftentimes do some autograph conventions that are pretty formidable, and they'll be in like big locations in the South and in Texas,
right,
and areas like that.
Right.
Of course, we haven't had anything like that over the last year or so.
Well, I personally,
but I don't know what the market's like now. I mean, is there anybody left? Oh gosh, that sounds cynical to me. But I don't know if there's anybody left whose autograph I want.
Yeah, I can understand that. But I have a theory that autographs are going to become very valuable, and here's why.
Good.
Number one, nobody writes letters anymore. Everything's text. Everything is an email.
Mm-hmm.
Message, Facebook, social media, stuff like that. Coupled with the fact that they, in some schools, not all across the country, they don't teach cursive at a young age anymore. So there goes the autograph. And coupled with the fact that in many cases, there are certain situations where you don't need an autograph, you need a thumbprint. You see? You don't have to sign your name. So I really don't know what's going to happen other than the fact that there's going to be less and less autographs because there's going to be less and less need, unless somebody comes up to you and says, Brian, may I have your autograph? Or Hercules, may I have your autograph? You know, and then you'll sign it if someone happens to have a Sharpie or a ballpoint pen or whatever, you know. And then you have to look at it from the standpoint of, is it genuine? I remember, this goes back 30 years, sports cards, okay, the autographs and stuff like that. They actually had a machine on television that could duplicate autographs.
Wow.
And that took the autograph business right out at the knees, because some of those autographs get pretty expensive.
Yeah.
And here you've got a machine that can duplicate them. So then you have to have somebody that has the savvy to authenticate it, you know. So, but yeah, it can get quite expensive. The only time I would ever consider an autograph is an autograph picture is if I'm in the picture and the individual is in the picture. I've given out autographs. I've had people approach me, but my point of view is this, and I always give them. But I say to them, I'll only give you an autograph if I can have yours.
Awesome.
And that sets them right back on their heels. I said, that's exactly right. I'm no more important than you are. And I've given out hundreds. So, and I always do. I always, give them an autograph. Do you want it personal to you as an individual or to a friend of yours or whatever? It's fine with me, or just my autograph. But I have to have yours. Yeah.
In general, when I get an autograph, I try to get, the actor to sign like a piece of movie memorabilia that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Something, from, her heyday or his heyday. And I've wound up with some really fantastic pieces like that. For example, I've got a Beach Party poster from the 1963 American International film. That's signed by Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon.
Wow.
Man, she was a heartthrob back in the day.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I have certificate of authenticity on it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to part with it. So, when I die, whoever does my tag sale, can wonder who these people are by then.
Something else.
Well, that's probably what will happen.
And here's something else that happened back in the day in the Clark Gable, Marilyn Monroe, and Gloria Swanson and the golden Hollywood days in the 30s and 40s. What a lot of the actors and actresses would do is they would always pay by check. Now, you know why. Because no matter what the cost, it could be a $2 item. $2 was a lot back then. It could be a $1 item, a $2 item, whatever. They would sign and give them a check. And the reason being is many of the people that got the check wouldn't cash it because they wanted the autograph.
That is awesome. And on that note, though,
I think that's brilliant.
It is. And on that note, though, we need to start sharing contact information. I had a lot of fun. And
yes, indeed.
Let's do this again. There's tons of Peplum stars, so we'll schedule another one. Brian, would you like to start with your contact information?
Sure. If you want to stop by and see the Many Faces of Hercules or perhaps one of the other 350 or so actors and actresses profiled, stop by briansdriveintheater.com. And if you'd like to reach out to me, the easiest way to do that is through my Facebook presence. You can log into Facebook and then run a search for Brian's Drive-In Theater, and that should take you right to me.
Thank you so very much. Bill?
You can find me on the Internet. Type in superstrengthtraining.com. And be sure and sign up for my free daily newsletters. It just asks for your name and your email address, and click send, and you'll be in for the next newsletter. I try to get them out every day. A lot of interesting history, training information, a lot of the information we talked about today. And by the way, Brian, it was a real pleasure speaking with you.
And it was with you, Bill. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very kindly. Same here.
And I'm looking forward to having another show together again, so we'll start planning that in the coming week. Thanks to both of you. This was awesome. And thanks to everybody who's tuned in, whether you listened to us speaking live or visiting us later on demand. Until next time, this is all of us wishing all of you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And I will close, like I often do, with "If You Can Dream." And the button's not working. There we go.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, there is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. Dream till it's real. Dream.